I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen. My co-host, Mark Edwards, will be bringing us insights from his lifelong interest in flooding.
You know, when you said you wanted to talk about flooding, I went and I have extensive file systems on flooding that I've been saving. I found some of them go all the way back to 1954. And so as I looked at those together, they kind of always want to set one thing off against another when it comes to the flooding. So we're always having discussions about the Corps of Engineers and how they could have controlled or made that flooding less or something, and who's going to adjust and address this problem. So we always come back to the endangered species part on the Missouri, because that's been a big part of the Missouri River. And the Missouri River is really unique in some regards because it's had a lot of alterations. And to give you an example, say, of that, the three large dams north of Iowa on that Missouri River have enough water. They hold enough water to cover the state here of Florida up to a depth of 2 feet in water if they let their water out. So that's amazing to me how much water we're talking there. So in this event, it's very particular or different from the other events because the farmers want to blame that the Corps is letting out water to address these endangered species. But actually, we had a real bomb cyclone event, which is a very unique rain event of extreme amounts of rain in a short period of time. And most of that landed below the dams on the Missouri River. So there was, in some ways, not the opportunity normally that the Corps would have to be able to address that, letting out how much water in and out of that dam. And so that added another feature to all this. And I think it's beginning to get a lot of press now because it affected not only the farmers getting into their fields and planting and all that silt deposit, but this is the first time in the long time, that farmers have stored grain. And they stored their grain because they wanted to wait till the prices went up because the prices have really dropped. And so they've really put a lot in storage this year that hasn't happened for many, many, many years. And a lot of that storage got wet. And so now there's no insurance to really cover that. There's no way they can the government can step in, the Department of Ag. And so now they're trying to figure out, well, what do we do about that? Because it's really going to affect things. So it's kind of a really unique situation this time. And I think, you know, again, like say when you place these floods in some kind of historical context, the other dimension to controlling that water by the Corps is barge traffic. And we've done a lot of alterations to that poor river, straightened it, rip-wrapped it, and changed it so that it doesn't go into a floodplain like it has for historical times. And so I found some statistics here that says the U.S. Department of Ag says barges carry 1/3 of 1% of the grain harvested in Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri. And it costs more to actually maintain that levees and all that than it saves those shippers. And so I read an interesting quote in the Des Moines Register. It's like building a 25-lane interstate for 735 miles that nobody uses. So it would be a lot less expensive to buy this land for wildlife and for flooding than to rebuild the levees. And I think that's where the discussion is coming in. We're trying to say which interests have the most priority here at this point. And we have a lot of sympathy for the individual people who've lost their livelihoods and won't probably be able to get back in and farm on that land yet this spring.
We have a guest who actually experienced being flooded out with this flood. Is John Davis with us?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, John.
So you, I understood from the Aladdin, our engineer who made the call, that you had a little problem even getting up this morning because of, well, I suppose it's the weather. Was it your electricity went out?
Yes, a major transformer broke 10:30 last night, and we didn't get power back until about 4 this morning.
So where are you right now?
I'm in Hamburger, Iowa. It's in Fremont County in the southwest corner of Iowa.
And are you in the house that was flooded out and that you're going to have to abandon?
Yes, I'm in the house.
You did get flood insurance for that, is that right?
Yes, I got flood insurance. Unfortunately, the damage to the basement and the wiring of the house is so bad, it won't cover the cost of replacement, so I'm going to have to abandon the house and move elsewhere to Council Bluffs.
Wow.
Well, this is particularly ironic for you. Were you actually in Hamburg when the flood came, or were you?
Yes.
You'd returned from the Philippines.
Yes, I spent 5 months in the Philippines. I'm a climate analyst, and I was working with the Philippine government. Returned on March 7th to my home here, only to have less than a week later a nice sunny warm day with rain and a biblical-sized flood. So I was here from the very beginning.
Okay.
Well, we're a little curious on the bomb cyclone. I'm not sure which terminology they're using, but they were trying to say that it was somewhat of an unusual rain event that precipitated this event.
Yes, it is. Fact is, I followed it on satellite from the Philippines, and this started back in February. And in the first 4 days of February, if you can imagine the Arctic Circle with a ring going around it called the jet streams, the first 4 days in February, and usually high temperatures, a couple of days were in the 70s, and the rest of the time it was in the 40s and 50s. It's supposed to be minus 24, minus 14. And what happened, this huge amount of hot weather cut the jet stream and literally took the entire Arctic region, except for the ice caps, it took the entire Arctic region and had it slide across the globe, across Canada, into the Midwest.
Well, we knew that from the polar vortex. We kept hearing about the polar vortex.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was the largest polar vortex in history.
Wow. These new terms are just say something about something's changing here when we have to come up with these new terms to explain it. So with your background, could you give a little bit more about that? You're a climate activist. So give us a little bit more background in that. That sounds fascinating.
Okay. Yes. I'm a retired government employee. I was in the Clinton administration. I was a special assistant to Al Gore in the White House. And as you know, Al Gore, besides internet, was very, very interested even then in the environment. And so when I retired, I continued on with climate as a sign of hobby and became a full-time occupation for me. And so since the early 90s, I've been working on climate almost every day. I was knighted by the King of Spain in 1998 for my work in global warming. I've been across the world talking and lecturing, attending meetings on climate and climate change and helping where I can. I do a lot of writing, and so I'm followed quite a bit on Facebook and on blogs.
Well, boy, it's sure getting more and more attention all the time. The discussion I just saw that was that Al Gore's daughter won their law case or was dismissed for trying to bring the climate up to the public awareness. And so I'm kind of curious how you relate to all that, you know, where we're still discussing whether it's true or not. That's a hard question, I know, John, but I bet you've had to face it before.
Yes, I've had that question many, many times, and all I can say is look outside.
Yes.
Here's what's happened so far just in 2019. We've had disaster number one is what I call the St. Patrick's Day flood. Right after that, there was Cyclone Idea in Mozambique, which killed thousands of people. Right after that, there were two Category 5 massive storms that hit Queensland and Australia. And now we have a northeaster problem in the United States. Our weather has become extremely erratic because of climate change and what we're putting into the air. And this is causing instability across the world. It's felt most right now in the equatorial areas of the United States. My friends in the Philippines sent me photographs, and they have 100 million people on a small series of islands. They can barely feed themselves on a good year. This year, their rice crops, their farmland is cracked and parched and just cracked open because no rain. Same thing is happening down in Australia. They even had a mammal go extinct because of the heat. Yesterday it was 122 degrees in the Congo. And in the past 2 months, Australia and New Zealand had the highest temperatures on record. And so we're going to be seeing that effect up here, only we're seeing the opposite side. The heat coming up through the Arctic and causing these massive cold fronts to come down upon the United States.
Wow. Yeah, it's sure affecting people in lots of different ways, and I think we're all kind of struggling to make sense of it. You know, that's the thing with the science, and a lot of this seems somewhat beyond our comprehension. And I guess it was interesting for me, the other dimension to this is not only is the weather, but when I look through my files on flooding and we look at how we keep having these 100-year floods, a 500-year flood, another 500-year flood, you know, it's not making some kind of sense in a way. And so there's not only is the climate, but we've altered that landscape. You know, we're draining the water off the land quicker, you know, trying to control it more with these reservoirs and levees and all these different attempts at controlling something that, you know, is really beyond our comprehension almost, or for me it is.
Well, it's definitely beyond our comprehension. One thing that as you were talking about what's happening this year, I was reminded that during Hurricane Katrina, even people who were climate scientists were saying, we can't attribute this to climate change, but it's what they were what we've been predicting. It's what the models have been predicting. But now, almost everyone is saying, yes, this is climate change. And, of course, we haven't been doing anything about it, but we are reluctantly, we as a society and political entity, starting to talk about what we can do about it. What's your comment on that?
Yes. In November, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the section of the United Nations that puts plans, procedures out for climate change. For once, they've actually set a goal. And the goal is the year 2030. If the world does not reduce its carbon footprint, the amount of carbon we've put into the air, by 50%, we're going to have catastrophic human and weather issues that will make this flood look like it was absolutely nothing.
Wow.
And unfortunately, we're already seeing that. We're seeing this right now before 2030 is even started.
Well, we need to, at least we're seeing it enough that we're waking up and we're beginning to talk about things like carbon sequestration because I'm sure you know all the anything I might say, so I think I'd better just turn it back over to you.
Well, you know, this time frame, I think, is what's really rising on the horizon really fast is how many years, how much time do we have to start addressing this? And so, as Susan mentioned, we're talking about carbon sequestering and, you know, with the farmland in Iowa, the way it is and stuff, you know, that's something we really need to look at. And we're kind of talking about that with cover crops and things like that. But, you know, that's a long-range plan. So, you know, where do we go from here? How do we get in here and do something?
It's actually very simple and very complex at the same time. We should have been started doing things over 15 years ago. But there's a little thing called politics.
Yes.
And when you have countries, which we call them climate-denying countries, that refuse to accept the fact that climate change is here and that we are negatively impacting our entire environment in favor of the coal industries, we're not going to get anything done. And the top polluters in the world are China, Russia, the United States, Australia, and parts of Poland.
Parts of now Poland?
Parts of Poland, 80% of their power comes from coal.
Right.
And they hosted the COP24 UN conference on climate this past March.
Well, in Iowa, you know, we're looking at putting in a lot of wind turbines and going to that kind of renewable thing. We're talking about how fast that has to happen, how it happens and all that. But there's, you know, that, again, is also kind of a little bit longer range thing. And we're talking about even if we put in all the wind turbines, our coal plants are still continuing to run. So it's
yes.
And that, you know, that gives some confusion to this conversation, too, if we're trying to keep that carbon out of the air and we're just providing more energy all the time and yet keeping those coal plants running.
That's because the fossil fuel industry has had a stranglehold, literally, on Washington, D.C. for decades and decades. From 2006 to 2016, the fossil fuel industry's lobbyists saved $2.6 billion into giving money to congressmen and senators to ensure that there were no regulations, no laws passed that would affect the fossil fuel industries, and at the same time give them hundreds of millions of dollars of subsidies to keep them going. Coal is a dying industry, quite literally, but for matters of profit, they're going to do everything they can to keep themselves open. And with this current administration, it's become even worse.
Well, you know, it gets to the, for me on a personal level of, you know, at some point we're going to have to talk about the energy that we use because we just keep producing more and more energy. It doesn't matter the form. So now we're hearing discussion of nuclear energy, you know, those kinds of things. But making that transition to those renewables is going to take some time, and it also produces some carbon footprint. So, you know, somehow we've got to get this focused, and I think that new Green Deal that people are talking about, I don't really understand all the details, but it's kind of that conversation of how do we have a social movement? How do we socially agree that we have to make some drastic changes here and very quickly, which is what you're saying, I believe.
Right. And it's happened. It's happening globally. It's happening in the United States. It's happening with children, with young students. It's called the Friday Off movement. Every you heard about it.
We had a pretty active one here, especially with the high school students. It was interesting. High school students had theirs a few days early because they weren't going to be in school on Friday anyway. So they had it was a huge picture in the Ames Tribune, and then the college students did something on Friday, and it was not quite so big.
Uh-huh. But yeah, it's growing.
It is growing exponentially.
Right. And leading by the young people, I think, is really critical because they're at an age of looking to their future, and the rest of us are kind of maybe, how do we hang on?
pretty much.
No, it is very important that they are aware of this and knowing, because it's absolutely true. The older people talk about worrying about their grandchildren or what's going to happen to our grandchildren, but they're going to have to face it themselves pretty soon in their lifetimes.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. And the tragic part is that my generation, I'm turning 70 here shortly, our generation did this. Because we had a different dynamic, economic dynamic of mass consumerism. More is better. And we found out that more might be better in the short term, but in the long run, we've been killing off our planet. And so it's going to cause we're going to have an absolute major global paradigm shift in not only how we think, how we do things, how we produce energy, but also in how we eat. Believe it or not, in Iowa, you know, we have a large pork industry and a large beef industry. Cows and beef and pork give off the second most amount of pollutants into the air than anything else, including cars. Most people don't know that.
And that actually is something that's very, very hard for people to grasp. And so, of course, they're coming after you, your cars. The Green New Deal is going to tell you, I mean, your pigs, your beef, your steaks, your meat. Yeah. You can't eat. I'm a little worried about those cows that make cheese, too, because.
Well, John, there's another part. I was just reading this thing; it caught my attention. It said that we've switched to LED lights, say, because they're so energy conserving. But we actually ended up putting in more lights because of that than we got from switching to the LED. And I know over time that won't be true, but initially, I know people have been doing remodeling, and they're putting in a lot more lights in their house. And thinking, they're saving by putting in the LED. It's kind of ironic that as we get to this discussion of how are we going to, get back to what we basically need instead of our desires some way. So,
right. I mean, everybody doesn't need a TV in every room. They don't need a car for the wife, a car for the husband, a car for the kids. They don't need those. They don't need six computers in the house.
Right.
We consume far, far too much energy.
You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Mark Edwards, who is speaking with John Davis, climate activist, about how he views his own personal experience of being flooded out from his home in Hamburg to climate change. Well, we could go on that for quite a while, but just a minute though, because you are collecting the stuff that was in your house, a lot of it that you can't take with you. You, according to Ed Fallon, you are a climate refugee since you have to leave Hamburg and go. Where are you going to go?
I'm going to be going to Council Bluffs, someplace that's not in the floodplain.
Okay.
I've lost all of my paper, research papers, private papers, reports that I've had over 20 years. All I can say is thank God when I went to the Philippines, I took my computer with me, and I have a 2 terabyte external disk, which is nothing but climate data. I have probably one of the largest private collections of climate data of anyone you can think of, and I update that every single day.
Well, wow, John, our heart goes out to you because here's a person like yourself that's been following this and into the weeds, into the details, and then to have it personally affect you like that on that level is just ironic that we're all going to be in that situation, maybe the way things are going. So,
pretty soon. Well, I was reading a report 2 weeks ago about how the weather is radically changing around the world, and the way the temperatures are heating up. If we don't do anything, this is before 2030. About 2025, the area between Omaha and Des Moines, its normal temperatures would be up the same as Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Yeah, just trying to put this all together. It's just, we're just bombarded again with all these things. And then to have on this personal level of the news with the flooding and everything. And now we're talking flooding in the Mississippi River. And, it just goes on and on. So hopefully this will raise some awareness and help us pull together on this, because that's the only way we're going to be able to address this.
And I hope so. And what everyone needs to do is keep pinging on their legislators. Keep pinging on their mayors, their state legislatures, our congressmen, our governor, and start saying, hey, we're going to start voting, and we're going to vote for people who's going to be helping us, who are going to be pro-climate. And if you're not, we're going to vote you out. And 2020 is going to be a very crucial year for that.
Yeah, crucial, and we're not sure at all what's going to happen, but I was going to be hearing about it first.
Yeah,
we will hear about it first. Governor Inslee is going to be coming down here on April 12th to Southwest Iowa to take a look at the damage, and he's a presidential candidate and also a very pro-climate candidate. That's his number one topic. So we need more candidates that understand what climate is, and we need to educate our current legislatures about what climate is doing, and we have some great organizations in Des Moines that do that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and we do have another topic for this morning, so we will be as soon as you hang up, we have another phone call to make. So I will say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, John.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you. Stay dry.
Thanks.
All right.
That was John Davis, who is a climate refugee. He talked to us not only about his own personal flood out, but about the work that he has been doing since Al Gore. So over 20 years, he has been he's been collecting climate data. He's been visiting places all over the world and has been recognized and honored for that. And so he comes home to face it right in his own basement.
Yeah, and boy, to have it hit you like that. That's bringing your work home with you, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. And